Mancaro, CEO of Crime Stoppers of Houston. My fabulous co-host, the Contessa, is co-owner of Vintage Contessa and Times Past, and we're styling social justice with Runya and the Contessa. We have a very, very special guest. I would say female crush, Danae. I think you agree. Michelle Teagle, attorney extraordinaire. We're so happy to have you. How are you guys doing? You're matching in your pink.
Yeah, I love pink. I figured maybe it would brighten everyone's morning to wear a little bit of color today. Pink is one of my favorite colors. I remember back when I was water skiing as a kid, I had a coach and said, you'll grow out of that color. And I've never grown out of this color, and I'm not going to grow out of this color. Chet Rayleigh, if you're listening. So, but yeah, I'm doing okay. You know, life has definitely changed. The pace of how I'm doing my work and my cases has changed. I travel a lot normally. That's certainly been put on pause for now. But, you know, we can still do work, and you're just adjusting like everybody does right now. So,
I mean, we can attest to that. I don't travel as much. Danae, you travel all the time. I'm scheduled to travel in 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and my United's already canceled my flight, changed my flight without even telling us. It's just a completely new normal, and it's affecting every single one of us, literally, without question, and in so many different ways. But what I've loved is how quickly a lot of us have adapted. You know, we've quickly figured out there's a new normal. We will figure out how to connect. We'll figure out how to work. We'll figure out how to help each other. You know, we'll figure out how to revamp our businesses. I actually think it's inspiring. I mean, of course it's terrible. There's no question. Another news of a friend's, not a friend of mine, but a friend who lost a friend to COVID yesterday. But there are silver linings in the fact that we're such a resilient community.
Yeah, I'm definitely seeing that, and how my clients are adjusting, how the courts are adjusting. It's just one big adjustment and one big change. And I don't think any of that is going to be different overnight. I think we're kind of in this transformational period for the long run, but I think good things can come from it. Overall, it's not good, but I think that our society and our court system are going to adjust, and some of those things we may keep, and that's not all bad.
It's not all bad. Well, let me formally introduce you. Michelle Simpson Teagle grew up in Bridgeport, Texas. She now represents clients nationally in serious injury and death cases, the sexual abuse of survivors, and other crime victims in civil lawsuits. She is a frequent voice in the media from CNN, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and USA Today. She has received multiple honors, unbelievable distinctions. You are licensed to practice in Texas and New York, which for any of the lawyers out there means we know the BART exam she's taken, and like, God bless you. And you are on counsel in the New York, New Jersey area. We are so excited to have you on. My gosh, the unbelievable, you're so young, but the unbelievable work history that you've had. I just want to jump in and start with just the person. So you were born, you're a native Texan.
I am. I grew up in a small town in Texas, just northwest west of Fort Worth. So small town girl.
And your dad was an attorney.
He was, and he still is, an attorney in the small town, Bridgeport, where I grew up. And I think that did really shape sort of my path. And I have two younger sisters. I'm the oldest of three girls, and all three of us are lawyers. And I don't think that's by chance.
I can only imagine. Danae and I were talking about you last night, and I was saying, I imagine her dad to have been like the big shot attorney that, you know, the whole town went to. And I remember reading that your sisters and you married an attorney. I mean, it sort of runs in the family blood. And how powerful your dad's impression and representation must have been in your life. And I asked you the question over email. I mean, you're representing huge cases. We're talking about the victims in the Larry Nassar case. You're one of the first attorneys to file suit after the shootings in Las Vegas. I mean, you're representing massive, massive things. And we're going to talk to you about all of it. But how much of that really stemmed from your dad, from a mix of your dad and maybe personal experiences? I don't think it's fair to say you fell into it, but when I asked you the question, you said it was a mix of a little bit of all.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it is a mix. I mean, kind of going back to my dad, one of the reasons when people ask why the three of us all became lawyers, you know, a big thing was we watched our dad go to work every morning and he loves what he does. He's almost 70 and he will be a lawyer until he can't be a lawyer anymore. And the passion is contagious for doing something that you love. And my dad also, he's a plaintiff's attorney. He does mostly personal injury, but he represented individuals. He represented people. And I think that's the thing that really stuck with me and a reason why I didn't go work for one of the big firms that represents corporate clients. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It takes all of us. But I think it's why I was drawn, at least initially, to criminal defense, because I wanted to represent an individual person and to be their person and their voice and to get into the courtroom. And that's why I chose criminal defense as my first kind of career within the law, was to get that experience in the courtroom, which is hard to get now in civil litigation. And so I think that that definitely comes from my dad. That passion and interest in representing individuals. I think some of my passion for representing women and representing athletes, which I love doing, comes from my background and some of my college years and the education that I got at a liberal arts school, which encouraged creativity and thinking and talking about women's issues and taking women's studies classes for the first time. Coming from a really small town in Texas, it just opened a whole new world and a different worldview that kind of started to combine what I grew up with and what I was learning as a young adult.
And with your background, being such a strong athlete and going through that journey, that's the other thing in your praises, is I know people move on and you've had this amazing career, but to be top in any athletic field, in this country, ranked in the world, that takes discipline, commitment, and it isn't a team sport, but I sure had to connect with others on your team. Yeah. Was that also part of the journey? Was the coach you had? And I know you made to him earlier.
Yeah. He's probably not watching. He's probably on a lake somewhere right now. But you know, I think skiing played a really big part in what I took from competing and getting to that level, the discipline, the focus, the love for adrenaline. All of those things, I think, really did prepare me and also drive me towards being in the courtroom and doing media and being a trial lawyer. I think I get that same rush that I used to get before I would hit the water when I'm about to go on CNN or when I'm about to step in a courtroom and give an opening statement in front of a jury. It's the same feeling, but it is for a better purpose and it has more longevity to it, which I realized that I couldn't be an athlete forever. And so I'm grateful for those experiences. I got to travel the world competing. It exposed me to a lot of different viewpoints and life experiences and people who didn't live or grow up just like I did. And that is invaluable. And I'm so grateful that I had that. Sometimes I miss being on the water. I really don't ski a lot anymore. But it definitely took those tools that I've carried with me into my career, for sure.
And I think that we as parents, Renya and I specifically, and we talked to so many other parents, we want to inspire our greatness. And we were talking about how hard COVID is. And my daughter, who's turning 13 on Monday, has had such a journey, and so many of it is filled with tears over this hard, everything is harder. Yeah. And I guess I can look at you, and now as a 50-year-old woman, I can say, she did something hard in her head and she realized she could overcome it. One of our podcast guests before is Randy Rubenstein. And my favorite quote of hers to tell kids is, you can do hard things.
Yeah.
That has to be. And then for you to talk about how that translates to your victims you're helping. I love that you take that ownership and representing them, and you're so vested in their journey as part of this too, because it's not just plot, also such an emotional journey for these people that go through this. Can you share about that?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I wish I was an English major in college, and I wish I would have had more of a social worker psychology background, because what I do now, but some of it is just inherent in what we're drawn to and what we do. And, you know, such a big part of my job is not actually lawyering. It is being human and walking with my clients through what you said, really hard things. But I'm always so just astounded. And it's not just the Nassar survivors and the Olympic gymnast clients, but every single survivor, whether it's a 12-year-old girl or a 60-year-old man who is finally dealing with the abuse of that he had, you know, as a 12-year-old by a priest, I'm just astounded by the resilience and the courage of my clients to, you know, some of them, their path is not to speak out publicly, but even just dealing with it after so many years and doing something about it, even if you're doing it as a Jane Doe or a John Doe, the public path is not for every survivor and every client. And I think just to even pick up the phone and call me takes such courage for my clients. And so when they give me that honor of being that person, while I can't be everything to them and they still need to see a counselor and we all have to have boundaries for our own health and well-being, I want to be there for them. And I want them to feel like they can reach out to me and like I am one of their people. And that is not always the approach of all lawyers in different areas of the law. And it's not possible, it's depending on what type of case it is. But for these cases, it's necessary and it's really an honor. So,
Michelle, I think it's so interesting when you speak about that to think that you also come from the world of criminal defense. So I think it's just such an unbelievable difference that now you're representing the victims and the passion and the heart that goes into it. You mentioned Larry Nassar. I mean, that who wasn't moved/shocked/appalled at what the reality was for not just the girls in, on the U.S. Olympic team, gymnastics team, but all the victims of Larry Nassar. And you have to stop and think, like, how in this society where we're so evolved and we're so, we claim that we're so in tune to victims and the Me Too movement or whatever movement you want to talk about, how did this happen? And what I think is interesting, you represented some of these people. What was surprising to you? I mean, I would think you'd walk into any court of law and it would be like, don't even say anything. Done. He's guilty. Yeah. It's over. This is horrific. But, you know, our organization has worked to protect victims of sexual assault in camps in Texas. And I'll tell you, shocked by how hard the road is for the victims. I mean, what did you learn about the legal road that some of these victims have to go down?
I mean, kind of backing up and speaking to the first thing you talked about, which was kind of how I ended up representing victims coming from criminal defense. And one of the things that was most surprising to me starting in that work was clients in the criminal justice system don't end up in that system by chance. And it is a system that is just as harsh on the defendant and the victim and their family. And it is not an easy or a kind system to any of the parties involved. I still believe that it's the best, you know, system that we have in the world, but it's very imperfect and it's still very biased. And one of the things that I'm very open with the victims that I represent now, that I've represented people who were accused of sexual assault, and I represented people who were accused of sexual assault of a child. I'll admit that was not easy for me. That did not feel like a natural fit for me. But I was able to do that work because I would say upwards of 95% of those clients, probably close to 99, were victims first. And it is not an excuse, but it was something that as a human being could help me understand how they got there. And maybe that didn't mean they should ever be free, especially if it was a crime of violence. I'm a pretty strong believer that for crimes of violence, in large part, those people need to be taken out of society. But they're not inhuman. And they were little boys and little girls once too, and something caused that brokenness. And not all victims become perpetrators by any means, but almost all perpetrators were victims. And that's a really important piece of our system and of the problems that we're seeing with sexual abuse and assault that I don't have the answers to, but I know that it's one of the links that we're going to have to deal with if we really want to fix the problem. And I don't have those answers. That's probably a psychologist, but in trying to sort of understand the cases and the offender and help the victims, that was an important piece of the journey. The other piece that's kind of surprising and that I've learned from doing work on both sides has been how hard the criminal system is for victims to navigate and how it is not their case. When clients call me, they're often very wrapped up about the criminal part of their case, which I will advise them and walk with them through if they're my client. But what is really their case is the civil case, because they're the plaintiff and we drive that ship. The criminal case, they're a witness, the most important witness, but they are not in control of that case. And that's really hard for victims who are struggling and need and want that control back. And that's something that I try to work with mental health professionals and my clients to navigate and deal with that difficulty.
That's such an important point. And while, you know, we recognize that, I think hearing you say it and then thinking about how that's heard to a victim family is actually really, really compelling. Michelle, you've talked a lot about the work around statute of limitations for sexual assault cases and the recent changes in the law that you not lobbied for, but you were very active in helping push through, certainly not as a lobbyist, but share what those changes were and what they actually mean for victims.
Sure. So in each state, and statute of limitations is how long the potential plaintiff, the person who's filing the lawsuit, would have to file a lawsuit. Those differ state by state. Those laws are different, and you will see almost 50 something versions of these laws around the country. In the state of Texas, the statute of limitations for a victim who is an adult to file a civil lawsuit against the perpetrator or any responsible companies or institutions is 5 years from the date of the sexual assault. That has remained the same for years. For a child, and this is a really difficult area, and my best advice to anyone who's listening or to any family members of victims is call an attorney, because it really is a little bit of a math problem still in Texas. I hope that we can work to change that for victims. But the law that applies is typically the law that was the law either at the time that you turned 18 or the time of the assault. The law in the state of Texas for how long you had to file a civil lawsuit in 2007 if you were abused sexually as a child was 2 years. They changed it then to 5 years and then to 15 years. And then just last year, the Texas legislature extended that statute to 30 years, and that's 30 years from age 18. That does not apply retroactively. So sometimes I get calls from victims, and just as an example, I'll get a call from a victim who was sexually abused in 1999, and they're, you know, years and years past age 18. And they say, the statute got extended. Can I file my claim against this ballet company where my ballet teacher sexually abused me? And their statute has run in the state of Texas. They were actually under the 2-year statute. So when that person was 20, their statute of limitations had run. That's different moving forward. As of September 1st of 2019, now a victim has 30 years after age 18 to file a civil lawsuit against both the perpetrator, so that would be Larry Nassar, and against the institution that turned a blind eye or was responsible in some form. So like USA Gymnastics or Michigan State in that case. And that's really important because we know now, and there's actually a lot of data available, and a lot of that is posted on the Child USA website, which is an organization that has lobbied for a lot of these changes in the law. And we know now that survivors usually don't come forward and even reveal sexual abuse until their 50s. And so the reason a lot of states have been changing these statutes of limitations is to be in line with what we know is the case for most people, is that they can't come forward and report it when they're 20 years old. They haven't even dealt with it within themselves, much less reported it to an attorney or a police officer. And there are certainly exceptions, but one of the changes that I hope that we'll see in Texas that we have seen in a lot of other states is what's called a revival window. And New York, New Jersey, California, even states like Arizona have recently passed them, more red Republican states. But these windows revive claims for victims for a set period of time, usually 1 or 2 years. And so maybe that woman who had the claim from 1999, she can't file her lawsuit, but for 1 year that claim is revived and she has another year to file that claim. And it's usually very publicized in the states where they pass this legislation to give victims notice that they have the ability to file their claims. And that's going on now in a lot of states, and there's definitely a wave of that legislation. And we were involved, and I say we, it was really the survivors that I represent who testified in the Texas Senate on the 30-year extension. And I would say that they are the ones that helped get that passed. But we hope we'll see a revival legislation piece, maybe in the next session. I think it's a tall order in Texas, but you know, it shouldn't be a partisan issue. Sexual abuse and assault is something that affects all people and all genders and everybody on the political spectrum. And protecting kids and giving people more time to litigate and deal with and get justice for these things should not be a political issue, but sometimes it is.
Renya and I came together over this topic. We really, this was when we first met. This is where my passion goes into this. And it's gone to now we really fight sex trafficking together. Certainly I'm so passionate about so many things. But I chose to really dive into creating safe schools and to try to reach out to kids because I thought if we could, from the ground level, if they're not learning it at home, but if they can learn through their schools, through Crime Stoppers, through education, through their counselors, teachers, that they could create change and they have a voice and people fighting for their voice. So are there things that you've learned through your journey that we could incorporate into what we're doing in our outreach to these kids? Because sometimes they don't want to admit it. Sometimes they're covering it up. Like you say, they go on and repeat it, or they cover it up with drugs and alcohol. It's just a magnitude of journeys that then lead to more crime. It's such
I mean, one of the things that I think will, the more access and the more less stigma there is to it, is access to mental health care, and that kids feel like talking to a counselor and even going to a counselor doesn't mean you're broken. It means you're human. And that if we start making that more accessible for people, regardless of race, class, where you live, what insurance you have, our country has such a broken mental health care system, and COVID is about to really, really magnify that. It already is. And the fact that, you know, our jails and prisons are our largest mental health hospitals in this country is a real testament to how people are being helped. They aren't. They aren't at all. And I think that y'all are going into the schools and speaking to them and making kids aware of these issues is part of the first step. But I think kids having the opportunity to be in that safe space one-on-one with a safe person like a counselor, regardless of where they go to school or what insurance their parents have, that is going to be one of the first steps for kids having the opportunity to disclose some of these things and deal with some of the trauma that many people have at an earlier stage in life. And to disclose things that maybe happened at home or happened, you know, with a teacher or coach, because they're in that safe space. So I think talking about mental health and how it's a good thing and it's a necessary thing for most of us at different phases in our lives, and making access to it wider and not a bad thing is a huge piece of that. But just having the conversations that y'all are having is the first step. But then we have to find ways to change accessible and to make people feel like they have someone to tell about whatever it is that's going on in their life or that they're struggling with. And I think that's a missing link I see with a lot in the criminal justice system and with the victims I represent now.
And I, when you speak with so much non-judgment.
Oh, I try.
Say it, but which is so not what people expect of an attorney. Like, yeah. You are the antithesis. You're blonde. You're attractive. You're so. How I used to be in the construction industry.
Right? Yeah. That's a male-dominated world. Yeah,
for women to show up in pink on a job site is different. I mean, Renya, being in this group of men in the crime-solving industry, can you talk about how, what part of your journey sort of brought you to that place of non-judgment? Because I feel like it's exonified with social media. We're just all judging everything. And now COVID, you're ashamed if you're not wearing a mask. You're ashamed if you're, it's just all so intense.
Yeah. I think, you know, some of it I think is just me and the way that I communicate. And some of it is what I learned through criminal defense and trying to connect with those clients who, when I went into the jail to meet with them as a 27-year-old blonde female, and I was speaking to, you know, an older man who had been through the system 3 times and he didn't want to hear anything of what I had to say. And I think I had to learn to communicate in a way that would allow them to see, I can tell you that I care, but I'm going to show you, but I'm going to keep telling you too. And I want you to feel like I'm not here to judge you. That used to be one of the first things I would tell my clients in criminal cases was, my job is not to judge you. I need you to be straight with me and tell me how I can help you. Because if I don't know the truth, I can't help you. And that non-judgment and them feeling like I was a safe person in a safe place was one of the ways that I could do my job for them. And I didn't get through with every person, and it was a lot of trial and error. And certainly had people who, you know, you just can't ever bridge that divide with. But I think that helped and was a great training ground for learning how to communicate with really tough people.
And I mean, it makes me think about you've seen some of the most difficult situations. And again, we talked about victims of sexual abuse. Again, we talked about the fact that you represented families in the Las Vegas shooting. When you are now just observing society, and one of the things you and I talked about was like the ride sharing angle, and you see families being so relaxed about what, you know, maybe what their kids are posting online, or, you know, the fact that they'll just jump into whatever ride sharing platform, and you've seen all these things. I mean, is it hard for you to just sit back and watch it? Do you want to scream like, no, this is what I've learned? I mean, when we think about ride sharing specifically, it's one of those issues where I've always felt so uncomfortable. And we've gotten into conversations with some of the big group, you know, the Ubers and the Lyfts of the world. And, you know, they're advocating, they're so safe. They are the safest platforms out there. But yet we see the stories, you know, of sexual assault, of, you know, that Boston case sticks out to me just so deeply. And you've represented victims in these cases. We're certainly not saying that ride sharing is wrong or bad, but you have learned a lot about it. Can you share what you've learned, but also, you know, going back to my original thought, do you sometimes want to just sort of tell families, wait a minute, before you do this, think about blah, 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 or do you kind of keep your mouth shut? Like, maybe I won't offer information.
No, I mean, I definitely, it definitely has impacted how I think about rideshare. And when I do see people like putting their small children in an Uber or a Lyft, no judgment, of course. I know everybody has different reasons and we don't all have the same situation or children even, but those are not safe spaces for a kid who may not be able to disclose something or, I mean, they're children. And you're putting them in a car with an adult stranger who, you know, in most states, including Texas, has not had an extensive background check. And Uber and Lyft, of course, have disputed this and tried to publicly act like this is something that has changed. And I think changes have been implemented in some ways, but I still have seen cases within the last 2 years where there is a person with multiple criminal convictions behind the wheel. Do you want your kid alone in a vehicle with that person? Do you want your sister or your wife or your friend or your brother who is vulnerable from alcohol in a car with that person, not even children? And so, you know, I've definitely seen, and one of my beefs with the rideshare companies is that they have spent a lot of money and lobbied, especially in the state of Texas. In the 2017 legislative session, they spent several million dollars and hired many lobbyists, Uber and Lyft did, to pass House Bill 100, which a lot of people know about that bill because it connected to the whole saga in Austin with having not having rideshare in Austin. But what the real fight in Austin was not just about having or not having rideshare. It was about the cities wanting to be able to regulate rideshare because they felt like if the cities couldn't more stringently regulate them, then they weren't going to be as regulated, which is exactly what's happened. We do have a statewide regulation of rideshare in Texas, but in many respects, and I've done a lot of research on this, I think you might be safer in a cab. Because a taxi cab driver normally through their company is going to have a more extensive background check. And of course there are exceptions to that, but you're also sadly more safe if you do the more expensive option. In most cities, Uber Black, the Uber requirements say that an Uber Black driver, for example, in the city of Houston has to have a limo license. Well, then the city of Houston does more heavily regulate limo license drivers, and they have more extensive background checks. They carry more commercial insurance if you were to get in an accident. And that is something that's a real a problem that people are not aware of until it happens to them or someone they know or love. But the rideshare companies should not be allowed to follow different rules than other companies or taxi cabs. They should follow more rules, not less. And, you know, I think it really comes down to profit. And these companies have a lot of power by virtue of the lobbyists and the money they're willing to spend to lobby for these laws. But I've been talking about it a lot because I want Texans to know about it and I want people to know about it. And I hope that in the coming legislative sessions, people will be writing their Texas senators and Texas House reps saying, we are not okay with Uber and Lyft playing by different rules. And that also applies with physical personal injury cases. There have been caps placed. So if you get in a serious injury in an Uber and your leg is amputated, which I know of a case where this happened, you may not be able to recover for your medical bills because Uber is not on the hook for that under Texas law. The driver is only, and they may not carry much insurance. And so you're literally putting your physical health and well-being more at risk. That doesn't mean that I don't sometimes also have to ride in Ubers, but I can tell you I don't like it. And I think about it and I worry about it.
I agree 1,000,000% with everything you're saying. It's most people can't imagine that the system exists without multiple redundancies and safety being in place. And the reality is it's not the case. And I've always said, take a cab. And people are like, cabs? Oh my gosh, they're older. They're, you know, Uber, the cars have to be clean. They give you water. And I'm not singling out Uber. I'm saying ride sharing, they're rated. You know, they're going to give you a cold bottle of water. The car has to be spotless. Sometimes they let you charge your phone. That's all great. But when you look behind it, there are so many cracks in the system that allow for things like sexual assault, like you're saying, car accidents where injury is prevalent. We were in a ride sharing not too long ago, and I don't take them unless I must. And I remember that this driver was going so fast. At one point, my husband said, I think you should slow down a little bit. And he just looked at my husband and didn't acknowledge him. And then he took a different route. And my husband even said, this isn't the way. And he looked at my husband and didn't acknowledge him. And we got there fine. But when we got out of the car, I said, can you imagine if one of our daughters was alone? I mean, 18, let's say she's older, but still, one of our daughters was alone in the car and said, I don't feel comfortable. And he could just turn and once you're in the car, they can do whatever they want. And it's not to assume that everybody in the world is bad or people are out to get you. Not at all. It's a very small percentage. I think what's so unique is the fact that you're saying you're pushing the narrative, making sure Texans realize that they may not be as safe as they think in these particular situations. And we want to make sure they are. We want to make sure their kids are. And that's why it's really important that people like you, organizations like Crime Stoppers, partners like Danae, and the voice in the network that she has, pushes for these conversations just to get everybody on the same page. And it's never to hurt business. We want businesses to come to Texas and to thrive in Texas, but we want people to be safe too. And that's not a paranoid statement. That's just a statement that we've, you know, out of love and economics and family safety and health and well-being and all of it.
Yeah, no, completely agree.
I'll jump to one more topic, and because I'm very curious about this. Danae and I talked about it quickly last night too, and we were kind of dissecting how fabulous you are. The Me Too movement, it goes through different phases. People say it was the greatest thing to happen to female employees in the workspace. There are other people say actually, while there was good to it, it was actually very bad for women in the workplace. You've seen some of these cases head on. What is your thoughts on that?
Overall, Me Too has been a really important turning point for women, and not just women. I think we think of Me Too as a women's movement, and it has certainly been very centered and important in that way. But when I think of Me Too, I think of some of my survivors who are men too, who have felt that they have more of a voice now as a survivor. And so, you know, Me Too has to me largely been a positive thing. I think, you know, the old criminal defense lawyer in me sees the flip side, that we can't completely abandon the principles that have been so important in our country, that people have the right to an attorney, that they should be presumed innocent in the criminal justice system before, you know, they have certain rights, and those rights should never disappear. Individuals have those, but that women are not going to just be attacked and disbelieved, that policies and practices are changing in the workplace, that women are starting to feel supported when they come forward by the collection of all of these voices nationally that have now been doing this for several years, like we've never seen before. Those are all good and necessary changes. But one of the things I always look at, and I think a lot of women have this reaction, is the Me Too movement is not a revelation. I mean, for a lot of us that have been in the workplace, have had our own experiences, the fact that these things were happening are not like, oh, this is news to us. None of this is news to us. But what is so important about it is that it has opened the floodgates to the conversation and to the conversations and the platforms that are so important, like y'all are doing, that it is needed. And I hope it will continue. We can't forget about constitutional rights, and those are certainly important, but the voices of women are being heard, and there's always a flip side to that, but that's a great thing. And I hope it will just continue.
It's such an interesting thing when you bring up, you know, our platform and the way that was the reason we came together. We were women who saw that when we were at charity events and doing lunches or whatever, women truly were talking about these issues. And I know when I grew up, I came from a very conservative Texas family, which sounds similar to your background.
Yeah.
And my dad thought of his feminist as Gloria Steinem, and I think of myself as a feminist, very different than Gloria Steinem.
Yeah.
But we're having a voice and rights and all of that. I've been so blessed to have people like you. Mike Resendez came and spoke to us, and him exposing the molestation in the Catholic Church. Brenda and I both have, I actually crazily have a journalism degree. She wanted to grow up and be Barbara.
Cool.
Part of our passion is getting these things out. So do you feel like there's so much about the media? Is the media real? Is it not? Do you feel like you have advocates in the media that will take the stories of your victims? Do you feel like we're kind of getting past these stereotypes of it's their fault or blaming, oh, it's the prostitute versus the woman who's being prostituted, like all of these.
Yeah.
You see that changing? Are there things we
I
can
do?
Do? To the way we talk about it together?
Yeah, I think you're asking great questions and important questions. And I do, I think the media, I am friendly to the media in large part. I think that the media, we have the survivors in the media that took the voices of the women in the Me Too movement and amplified them. And I'm not an anti-media person. I think y'all clearly aren't either. I think that we live in a country where the media has constantly been at the center of changing American life and helping get voices out that have not been heard in the civil rights movement, in the Me Too movement. So many things that have changed in this country for the better have been amplified. And I think it has helped to spread it in places maybe that are small, like where I grew up, that wouldn't have otherwise heard it had it not been for the media. And now for social media that has even more of a reach and is kind of even a different way of communicating and a different medium. But the media is so important for that. I'm still protective of the clients that I represent. And I realize, you know, I don't really believe in off the record. When when reporters are like, you're off the record, I'm like, I really trust you. And you've written great articles for my clients and you've never burned me. But I'm never off the record if I'm talking to you. And so I don't believe in that. And in that way, I'm cautious. But I think for the most part, my experiences and the experiences a lot of the survivors I've had who have participated in media have been largely positive and empowering. And I always talk to clients as we're preparing to file a lawsuit. And if it's a client who expresses maybe they want to be more public and they want to sit down with a local reporter or even maybe someone like Barbara Walters, that path isn't for everybody, but for the clients who go down that path, I have seen it be a path of really great healing. And that's why I'm a fan of it, and why if clients feel like it's the right thing for them, I encourage and will facilitate and walk with them through it. Because I have seen it be so empowering and healing. I mean, I think about the Nassar survivors, and it has certainly not been an easy thing. That doesn't mean it's easy or that it's always seamless. I mean, they're giving up privacy and they're putting themselves in a medium where that will never be reversed. Once you're out there and you tell your story, that's what I always tell my clients, we can't undo it. So we need to really be sure that's what you want. Because we can't undo what is done, even if it's a positive story. But I have seen that be so empowering and so healing. It connects them with other survivors and people who've been through the same thing. It gets the message out. It's overall been a really positive thing in a really awful situation. So.
Well, I can't thank you enough for being here.
Well,
I
thank love y'all. Spirit.
The word that comes to mind is you're just so authentic. You are so connected to your core values and authentic in the way that you share. Is there anything to tell women out there listening who are struggling with their place in life, or struggling with things that happen, or men? We have a lot of men listening.
Yeah.
Really, like how to get past maybe that fear or to really go and make that difference.
Yeah, I think, you know, my advice would be is that everybody has a story and most of us are struggling with things that we don't even know that other person is struggling with. And I have seen through my clients sharing their stories that there's a lot of healing in sharing that story, whether it's with a counselor or with a friend, with a lawyer. And I think there's a lot of healing and change that can come from that. And so I hope if someone's listening and they have a story, maybe it's not a story of abuse, but some story of pain or struggle, that in this time of COVID where we have more time to think and we're looking for ways to communicate and maybe thinking about ways that we can change the status quo, that they'll find someone to tell that story to. And sometimes that's through social media. And I think that's a great thing about social media. And I would communicate to the victims that I hope that if you are a victim and you've never shared your story, that you will with the mental health professional. And that if you have never shared it with an attorney, that you do that just so you know what your rights are and what your options are. One of the things that I was talking about yesterday with a survivor's mother was, you know, you don't have to report to the police if it's not ongoing and no child is in danger and it's years ago. The criminal part of the process may never be necessary for your case, and that's your choice. A lot of clients don't call me because they're afraid they're going to have to go through the criminal process if they call a lawyer. And unless someone is in imminent danger and still being abused, I can never disclose what they tell me. And they are, you know, whether I'm hired as their attorney or whether whoever they talk to is hired, that's a confidential conversation. And I think a lot of victims don't pick up the phone because they're afraid of that. And they're afraid of being thrust into a system that they don't want to be in. But when you call an attorney to have that conversation, you drive the ship. And so I think that if more victims knew that, more would pick up the phone and call an attorney to just see what their rights are. So
that's a huge, huge, huge point. I'm so glad that we ended on that note. And I'm just so thankful that you joined us on Silent Social Justice.
Well, thank y'all. Thank y'all for the conversations that you're having and the platform that you've created. And I love the fashion connection. I think that's so fun and so important. And, you know, I think people sometimes view fashion as a luxury, but to me, fashion is first of all, I think it's art. And second of all, I think it's also a way as professionals that we get to add dignity to the process for the people that we're a voice for. So I think it's an important piece. It's something that makes women feel good, and that is always a good thing. So thank y'all for bringing those two important things together.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. We're so thrilled to have you on with us today, and I'm sending virtual hugs and
love to be with y'all. Y'all are great.
Thank you. Thank you. And we will see you guys next week on Styling Social Justice. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody.
Bye. Thanks for having me. Take care. Bye-bye.